listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
What is it like to immigrate to this country when your own country has gone up in smoke? You know, I've thought about that a great deal from a personal standpoint. My own grandmother, who came here from Russia, fled her country during a brutal civil war. And over the last several years, I've learned more about the traumas that befell a young friend of mine who was a refugee from Sierra Leone. Dinah Mengistu's haunting new novel, All Our Names, follows one such African immigrant whose life has been scarred by armed conflict left behind. Named Isaac, this young man tells us how he left his small village in Ethiopia for the capital, Addis Ababa, and then to Uganda's capital, Kampala, where he is drawn into the violent revolutionary fervor at the university there. The era of dictators is brewing. Now he's been transplanted into a placid city in the Midwestern United States, remembering the city in Africa when the streetlights were cut off after midnight, remembering a story his father told him about a city that disappeared each night once the last inhabitant fell asleep, and citizens often disappeared without warning. You'll hear more tonight about this remarkable novel, about Helen, the restless social worker who is assigned to Isaac's case when he arrives as a foreign exchange student in her town. Helen's voice alternates with Isaac's to tell this tale that contains great sadness, much hard truth, and even durable victories for its characters. Dinah Mengistu himself came to the United States from Ethiopia with his family when he was 2 and grew up in Illinois. His debut novel, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, brought him widespread international acclaim and was cited as a poignant chronicle of exile. And his second novel, How to Read the Air, chronicled a young man's effort to come to terms with his parents' complicated past. He currently teaches at Georgetown University. He's also worked as a freelance journalist, making forays into war-torn regions of sub-Saharan Africa to write about life in Darfur, northern Uganda, and eastern Congo near the border with Rwanda. When awarding Mengistu a coveted MacArthur Fellowship in 2012, the committee lauded him for, quote, his depictions of the loss of culture, community, and landscape endured by immigrants in America that broadened the thematic concerns and voices encompassed by the American novel. He is truly one of the rising young stars of literature today. Our interlocutor tonight, Leila Lailami, another wonderful novelist and essayist, was born and raised in Morocco. She earned her PhD in linguistics at USC and is the author of the short story collection Hope and Other Dangerous Pursuits and the novel Secret Sun. Her essays and opinion pieces have appeared in many publications, including The Guardian and The New York Times, and in numerous anthologies such as the just released Dismantle, with stories and essays by alumni and teachers from the Voices of Our Nation workshop, and Immigrant Voices, released by the Great Books Foundation in Chicago. She's currently an associate professor of creative writing at UC Riverside, and her new novel, The Moor's Account, will be out later this year. Please join me in welcoming Leila and Dinah to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you all for coming. I want to start by thanking Louise Steinman for that wonderful and very generous introduction, and Sarah Charlton and Maureen Moore for helping put this event together. So today we're discussing, or tonight we're discussing Dinah Mengistu's new novel, All Our Names. And I thought, Dinah, maybe you could start us off by maybe reading from the opening of the novel to give people a feeling for what the prose is like.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming out, and to the wonderful people of the LA Public Library and Leila for accommodating me tonight. This is great because this doesn't need any setup. It's just from the very opening of the novel. And this section is narrated by Isaac. When Isaac and I first met at the university, We both pretended that the campus and the streets of the capital were as familiar to us as the dirt paths of the rural villages we had grown up and lived in until only a few months earlier, even though neither of us had ever been to a city before and had no idea what it meant to live in such close proximity to so many people whose faces, much less names, we would never know. The capital in those days was booming with people, money, new cars, and even newer buildings, most of which had been thrown up quickly after independence in a rush fueled by ecstatic promises of a socialist Pan-African dream that almost 10 years later was still supposedly just around the corner, that according to the president and radio, was coming any day now. By the time Isaac and I arrived in the capital, many of the buildings had already begun to show signs of wear, having been neglected or completely forgotten. But there is still hope in the brighter future to come, and we were there like everyone else to claim our share. On the bus ride to the capital, I gave up all the names my parents had given me. I was almost 25, but by any measure, much younger. I shed those names just as our bus crossed the border into Uganda. We were closing in on Lake Victoria. I knew Kampala was somewhere close on the other side, but even then I had already committed myself to thinking of it only as the capital. Kampala was too small for what I imagined. That city belonged to Uganda. But the capital, as long as it was nameless, had no such allegiances. Like me, it belonged to no one and anyone could claim it. I spent my first few weeks in the capital trying to imitate the gangs of boys that lingered around the university and outside the cafes and bars that bordered it. Back then, all the boys our age wanted to be revolutionaries. On campus and even in the poor quarters where Isaac and I lived, there were dozens of Lumumbas, Marleys, Malcolms, Césaires, Kenyattas, Senghors, and Selassies. Boys who woke up every morning and donned the black hats and olive-green costumes of their heroes. I couldn't match them, so I let the few strands of hair on my chin grow long. I bought a used pair of green pants that I wore daily, even after the knees had split open. I tried to think of myself as a revolutionary in the making, even though I'd come to the capital with other ambitions. A decade earlier, there had been an important gathering of African writers and scholars at the university. I read about it in a week-old newspaper that had finally made its way into our village. That conference gave shape to my adolescent ambitions, which until then consisted solely of leaving. I knew afterward where to go and what I wanted to be. A famous writer, surrounded by like-minded men in the heart of what had to be the continent's greatest city. I arrived in the capital poorly prepared. I had read the same Victorian novel a dozen times, and I assumed that was how English was still spoken. I said, "Sir," constantly. No one I met believed I was a revolutionary, and I didn't have the heart to claim I wanted to be a writer. Until I met Isaac, I hadn't made a single friend. With my long, skinny legs and narrow face, he said I looked more like a professor than a fighter. And in the beginning, that was what he called me, Professor, or the Professor. The first, but far from the last name he christened me. "And what about you?" I asked him. I assumed that, like others, he had another more public name that he wanted to be known by. He was shorter but wider than me, each of his arms tightly laced with muscles and veins that ran like scars the length of his forearms. He had the build but not the face and demeanor of a soldier. He smiled and laughed too often for me to imagine he could ever hurt someone. "For now, Isaac is it," he said. Isaac was the name his parents had given him. And until it was necessary for us to flee the capital, the only name he wanted. His parents had died in the last round of fighting that came just before independence. Isaac was their legacy to him. And when his revolutionary dreams came to an end, and he had to choose between leaving and staying, that name became his last and most precious gift to me.
Now, that's a wonderful opening to the novel, and I think you do such a good job of sort of setting it up for the reader. And I guess one of the first questions I had was, why that particular decade? So in the portion of the novel that you read, it's very clear it's after independence in Uganda, and we are seeing these young men sort of get swept up in the, how shall I put it, in the excitement of that era. So you have, you know, and not just in Uganda, but I was thinking also of the Congo, where you had an entire generation of people who had fought for independence and achieved it. And so when they had when they achieved independence, it was a huge reservoir of goodwill towards the people who went from being revolutionaries to leading their nation. Yeah. So for example, Patrice Lumumba in Congo, or Milton Obote in Uganda. And then something happened in that next decade, which is where you're writing about, and then you have these people who came to power through coups. So in the case of the Congo, you have Mobutu, and in the case of Uganda, you have Idi Amin, and in each case supported by former colonial powers. And so I guess my first question is, why that particular decade? Like, what inspired you about it? Why did you decide to write about it?
The initial idea was to try to write a story set in Africa that really began with this idea of optimism, that I wanted to cast this narrative not in the sort of like post-conflict era that we're oftentimes accustomed to, but that to locate the story in a moment that preceded all that. And that moment really, you know, sort of began in that post-colonial era. So like 1962, 1963, you have the emergence of a lot of independent African nations. And there's a lot of excitement and a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of optimistic ideals that were sort of being born at that particular time. And at the same time that I began to toy with that idea and began to sort of work on creating a group of friends who were set on a college campus somewhere in Kampala at that time, I began to think of also the way that particular narrative echoes the same strains that were happening not only here, but really across large parts of the world. So in 1962, you have the independence of many African nations through 1963. And in 1963, you also have the March on Washington, and you have the rise of the civil rights movement. And I began to realize that there were very strong, optimistic, and not revolutionary, but sort of very pro-democratic, very sort of liberating movements, like a series of national liberation movements happening across the world at that time. And that sets up this
Across the world.
Across the world. And that sets up this really interesting problem, because as you watch those independent movement rise and the enthusiasm and optimism rise, you're also very aware of the demise that accompanies that. And so you have sort of the death of Lumumba, you have the assassination of Lumumba. And you have the sort of transfer from Obote, who was actually already increasingly autocratic by the time Amin had come into power.
Already.
And you have the sort of frustration of watching men who had been great revolutionary figures and leaders slowly morph into autocrats and tyrants, partly as a result, of course, of the sort of politics at the time, but really also because these institutions of democracy weren't strong enough, by and large, to sort of support that. And while that optimism was still sort of there, I was really curious to see how you can sort of watch that, watch these young men who are sort of who arrive still born out of that desire and that optimism, and to see what happens when that slowly becomes deflated, and to watch how that also has echoes with, I think, of as our own frustration here. You know, after you have the civil rights movement, and that does so much, and you have the Civil Rights Act, but then you also you have the sort of reality of what happens post 1968 when you have the riots across much of this country, and you realize the civil rights movement has done so much, and yet at the same time there's this sort of entrenched legacy of economic, you know, sort of massive economic divide and still small, quieter forms of discrimination that exist.
And that was going to be actually my next question, which is about the so in the novel, you write about Uganda, but you also write about, or you write about Kampala, but you also write about the town of Laurel in the Midwest. And it is right after the civil rights struggle. So the laws, I mean, the Civil Rights Act has been passed and the Voting Rights Act has been passed, but people's minds haven't quite kept up with that. So that was the parallel that you were establishing. I have to tell you, I found the structure of your novel so delicate, so beautifully put together. The two, so you have these two voices, and in each, I mean, it is a thing of marvel how you wrote it. So I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about how you put it together when you did the structure of the book. Because you obviously have this idea that there's these two movements that are optimistic, but how do you put it together in the novel?
Well, also within that idea that you have these sort of two movements that are really optimistic, you also have the sort of accompanying idea I think of all novelists, that when you take any sort of large idea and you reduce it to the scale of an individual, you come up with something much more intimate, much more sort of palpable for the reader. Yeah. And so as soon as these stories got winnowed down and sort of not divorced, but sort of winnowed down to the sort of creation of the sort of man Isaac and this woman Helen, who's the narrator of the parts that happen in the Midwest, mm-hmm. once I had these two voices, they became, it became less about sort of, I wouldn't say less about these movements, more about how these two characters were trying to have a conversation
right.
with each other.
Right. I mean, I think that that's one of the things that you do so successfully in this book, is that even though it's set against this great background of political turmoil, it really is fundamentally about a very small yeah. cast of characters. It really is. I mean, it's not about, you know, you don't have 20 characters in the book. I mean, you have a very small cast of characters.
Without a doubt. And not that I want to divorce this from the sort of political ideas that surround it, but it is also very much deeply about those characters. And so as this sort of narrative started progressing, you could see Isaac talking about his life in Kampala and the sort of forms of sort of frustration that arise from that, of being young, a young man who's poor on a college campus and wanting to make something of himself, to the same way that echoes what happens in a small town in the Midwest when an interracial couple walks into a diner manages to find themselves discriminated against. And even across the sort of ideas of just even the narrative of a college campus in Kampala versus a college campus in the Midwest, these two places began to echo each other really quickly. Not because I was trying to force them to, or because I had to perform any sort of like magical tricks as a writer, but just because I think our lives echo each other really naturally. You know, I think mm-hmm. Once you begin to kind of look at individuals' narratives as people, you find the ways in which we mirror each other really closely, that we all experience the same level of anxieties and frustrations and loss in really similar ways. And Isaac and Helen began to kind of perform that for me quite naturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, since we are talking about this small cast of characters, the other thing that I thought was interesting is that how everybody else sort of recedes in the background. So we have Helen, and we have her mother, and we have her boss, David. And then in the storyline that's in Uganda, we have Isaac, and we have, you know, the narrator and all of that, and Joseph, the revolutionary leader. But pretty much everybody else kind of fades into the background. Even the people that are at the university, the students, no. you often refer to them as the boys or those boys. And so I wondered about that choice. I wondered about the deliberate choice of sort of forcing certain things into the background at the level of character.
Yeah. That choice was also partly because I think the other strain within the novel is that it's also a series of love stories, mm-hmm. Without making that sort of sound too sentimental
or maudlin.
But there is the idea that what I was really kind of, once the characters began to find themselves in motion, I was really curious about the way these two friends on this campus are in love with one another. They have this sort of deep, profound, intimate friendship that's so essential to who they are. All the sort of struggles and violence that they're willing to undergo through together are less about the function of any greater desire other than to be with someone that they care about and someone that, through that caring, actually recognizes, knows them, supports them. And the relationship between Isaac and Helen in the Midwest, divorcing it from anything else, it was also about watching two people come together and fall in love despite all the reasons that they shouldn't do
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
And the third one being also between this other man and Joseph, yeah. sort of very quiet, slightly hidden and very almost isolated love story between two men
who are
lovers and yeah. are unable to express that and unable to sort of show that in any possible meaningful way.
Yeah.
So all those other things do recede, and they recede in order to give light to that, that you can strip the novel of many other sort of social political contexts. Mm-hmm. And at the end, I think, or I hope that you still reside with the sort of portraits of love that are, to me, more essential than anything else.
Really. Yeah. No, you do that beautifully. I mean, I thought it was very, very touching, all the love between Helen and Isaac, and also in the storyline in Uganda between Joseph and Isaac. So I thought that was just beautifully rendered. The other thing, too, with this novel, because you have these two narrative voices, one is Isaac, obviously, in Uganda, and one is Helen. But in one case, one is a young Ethiopian man, and in another case, it's a Midwestern white woman. So I wondered about this, how you went about writing it, inhabiting these two very different voices. Did you write them separately, each, you know, or did you write them together? And how? So I was just wondering about that. Process of writing such different voices.
I wrote them together, always at the same time, and you know, also because one character couldn't have existed without the other.
Yeah.
And I've said recently that Helen's voice was actually in many ways easier to write, and she was. She was the
easier
to
write.
Easier to write by, I wouldn't say by far, but to some degree, you know, like my family came from Ethiopia. We arrived in the Midwest. We were raised in a sort of small town. And a lot of the women who took us, my family, in, they were women like Helen. They were women who
social workers.
Church. They weren't. No, none of them were ever social workers, but they were women who just were sort of willing to open their doors to a foreign family that they had never met. Mm-hmm. Women who had never known anything about Ethiopia, but helped raise me when I was a young man, while my parents had to work multiple jobs to support us, and they did so just willingly and with such grace and with such open hearts that trying to imagine my way into Helen's voice, partly as a result of knowing those stories, was quite easy. And at the same time, Helen isn't a reflection of those people either, because she does come with her own set of baggages, and the sort of there's a complexity to their relationship that's very much divorced from my own experiences. But at least I knew where to locate Helen's personality to some degree without feeling like somehow I was making any leaps of imagination, or that I didn't, or that I was straining myself to do so. I felt like I knew her to some degree quite easily.
But I mean, you have great imaginative empathy. I mean, with her, and no. So tell me now about writing Isaac, because you said that you found it almost easier to write Helen. Was it then therefore harder to write Isaac? Why was it harder to write him?
He was harder because he had to do more to some degree. Helen is sort of located in a very sort of small town in the Midwest. Isaac, I had to get Isaac not only sort of out of Ethiopia, but to have this sort of character who is also not sort of an active participant in a lot of the sort of conflict and violence that emerges through those parts in Africa, but who's also there as the sort of as the bearer, as the witness of a lot of sort of things. And that's a different role to situate a character in, because you don't want to make them completely passive or completely oblivious, but yet at the same time, their role is to kind of watch and observe and to sort of to try to help render this sort of reality and these other characters through as much compassion and through as much attention through as much concentrated narrative gaze as you're capable of delivering through them. Whereas Helen's experience for me was much more based on the sort of emotional reality of this woman and her relationship to this particular man. Isaac's relationship was to the narrative is much more about somebody who is on the sort of precipice of a large series of political and personal movements and has to try to figure out where his own role is, but at the same time also how to play the role of witness, because that is a lot of what he does. He is kind of bearing witness to a lot of to a lot of violence and to a lot of love at the same time.
Yeah. So it's interesting too with Uganda, because in the Uganda portion of the novel where you're writing about the revolutionary leader, Joseph, and you know, he does many things in the book, but what really struck me about him is how complex he was. So you expect him to be a particular kind of a man, and you know, and a revolutionary, but also a very brutal man. But he is just so. You give him so much complexity. He's not what people would expect. I mean, I know if you hear the name Joseph and you hear Uganda, you think Joseph Kony, right? Kony 2012, or you know, but it's so I thought it was very interesting how, you know, he had that name and yet he was so completely fully realized as a character. So, I mean, tell me a little bit about writing him and how you managed to kind of rescue him from what could easily have been a cliche, really.
You know, he came in many ways. The very first novel that I ever tried to write was the sort of failed, terrible story of a group of young men, one named Isaac, another one named Jonas, and another named, and the father of both of them,
yes.
Joseph. Mm-hmm. This novel was never published because it was very bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I always want to invite people to come to like my mom's basement and read this with me as real proof of how bad this book was. But one thing that novel did do was set out the sort of group of friends who were also dominated by sort of very kind of violent and problematic man named Joseph. And that was when I was, you know, 19 and 20, and I wrote this novel for many years, and it failed completely, of course, but these characters lingered in a long time in my imagination, and Isaac, it was named Isaac because that character to some degree carried over into this novel, and Joseph was born really there. He was born as the sort of sad, kind of tragic father figure, and that's why he made his way into this novel as well.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And the other parts were also, you know, there were, you know, sort of certain military figures that I'd met as a journalist. There was a colonel in Eastern Congo who I'd spent time with, mm-hmm. who in some ways became sort of a model for Joseph as a character who is has a potential for a certain level of brutality, but not a sort of gross, not a brute brutality. He does so because he genuinely believes that there are problems inside of his country, and the only way some of those problems, the only form of political expression that are left to them is violence, that it's you don't have recourse to democracy. You can't go to a ballot box and vote your president out because he's not going to leave. And so what you are left with are the forces of military might. Mm-hmm. And this man genuinely believed that, and he also believed that he was doing the best that he possibly could for his country. And I was compelled by him a lot, and he lingered in my imagination. But then I also wanted a character like Joseph who is sort of also very much haunted by the legacy of colonialism. You know, Joseph is an affluent, privileged man growing up. His father was a potential sort of political leader in sort of post-independence Uganda, and he's killed by sort of forces related to the president and sort of autocratic regimes related to that. And he also grows up and is educated in the UK, and it's there that he says, you know, it's really because of the British and the sort of colonial experiment that taught us how to kill, that we've learned that our lives are perhaps disposable because of what happens inside of the states. He doesn't genuinely believe that, but he knows that to some degree that is one of the legacies left behind that. And so I wanted him to be... I don't ever think of him as being a sort of... He commits acts of violence without a doubt, but they're never acts of violence committed namelessly or out of any just sort of brute desire.
Totally. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he also has this incredible capacity for tenderness, like his relationship to this other young man, also named Isaac, that he really loves mm-hmm. and cares for. Mm-hmm. And there's that thing where he is, to some degree, not trying to do all this in order to make a special place for this man, but because he also knows that he wants a sort of better world, and perhaps in this other world that will may or may not ever come to exist someday, that these two men can also continue to have the sort of private life and this private relationship, which extends to the sort of slightly idealistic notion that he also has about wanting to make this a better place, a better country than the one he's inherited.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing I wondered about the novel is I was struck by how few details of setting there were in the book. So when I remember from your first book, for example, The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears, how very precise like the landscape was. I mean, I remember very clearly what DuPont Circle felt like or what the neighborhood in D.C. felt like. And it made sense given the themes of the beautiful things that heaven bears, you know, with gentrification and everything and the change in neighborhood. It kind of made sense to have such a clear setting. But I wondered with this book, because even in details such as the thing that you just read for us, where you mentioned the conference that that the narrator hears about, but it never says anywhere that it's the 1962 Makerere conference. And so I wondered, why remove those details from the book? Like, what motivated that choice? Like, so few details about setting.
I mean, you know, I do believe that part of what I've always wanted to do, and I'm curious about, is how the stories in the landscape that I'm creating is the sort of basis of the necessity of what my narrative needs and what my characters sort of really need. And I could have named it 1962 Makerere Conference. I could have said this is sort of the reign of Obote just before Amin comes into power. And I was very careful, actually, about making sure that some of these things aligned really closely to what actually happened historically. But I also didn't want the novel to sort of be limited by that, because for me that was not my sort of intent. My sort of belief in fiction is that its value isn't because we're going to sort of recreate other semi-forms of historical fact, but because we're trying to sort of achieve some other more compelling form of narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this great line from Marilyn Robinson's Housekeeping where she says, "Facts tell us nothing. If anything, it's facts that need explaining." And my curiosity wasn't to try to sort of explain the facts of 1970, 1971, Kampala, Uganda, or even the same extension, what happens in a small fictional town in the Midwest.
Right. I mean, and that's the thing, that you're very consistent in both cases. It's not as if you're taking away details of setting from the Uganda and like putting them elsewhere.
Exactly.
In both cases, you're not putting any details.
There's no state named in the Midwest. It's just sort of a town named Laurel.
I choose to believe it's Minnesota.
I choose to believe it's Kansas. Actually, which isn't actually even true. I choose to believe that it's nowhere, actually, to some degree. And partly because I love the idea of being able to occupy a landscape that is slightly denuded of that, and seeing how much what else arises out of that space, you know?
Right.
One of my favorite sort of books is also like that same Marilyn Robinson novel, Fingerbone, uh-huh. where you never actually have a sort of state or place, but you're left with something else that's much more, that has a much more sort of residual impact for me as a writer. It's the sort of complex relationships of these people, and for me also very much the politics, but not the politics that are tied to a specific president or man, but the politics that I believe in that are not about sort of left or right, but the sort of residual effects of any large-scale movement on individual lives. And
I mean, it's interesting. It's almost as if it's like halfway between historical and allegorical, right?
Yeah.
But not. It's interesting. Okay, so would you like to read? I thought like another good place to read would be a scene from the Minnesota, the Laurel, the Midwest section.
Midwest diner.
Yes.
So this is from Helen's scene, and this is Helen and Isaac at a diner in Minnesota.
So now everybody's going to think that the novel's set in Minnesota when he did. Doesn't say it says the Midwest, but we'll see. I guarantee you by tomorrow.
Our waitress came and took our order. I ordered the fried chicken. Isaac pointed to the Denver omelet and let me order for him. After our waitress left, I turned my attention back to the counter. I wanted to tell Isaac what my father had said about Bill, but he was no longer there. With him gone, the men at the counter stopped pretending they weren't staring at us. I tried to ignore them, but then our waitress came back empty-handed, and I felt certain that if I looked over again at them, I'd see them smiling. She was young, fresh out of high school. Had I been younger, I would have known who she was. She had a kind, round face and wore her dark brown hair in a bun. She leaned over and whispered to both of us, "Bill wants to know if you would like to take your food with you." She was doing her best to be kind. Isaac understood immediately what was happening and in the same breath knew how to respond. Before I could answer, he told her, "No, we would rather eat here." Polite yet determined. She nodded her head. She had no idea what else she could do. Isaac pursed his lips and waited until she had returned to the kitchen before turning his attention to me. "Do you come here a lot?" he asked. I nodded yes, then changed my mind, and said no, not really. "Which one is it?" "I used to come here when I was younger," I said, "but I don't that often anymore." It was true. The diner was a few blocks away from my office, but I went there once a month at most and never on Saturdays. "We should go again," I said. Isaac had stopped staring at me since the waitress left. I was tempted to confess my reasons for bringing him, but I realized I didn't have to. The best intentions didn't change what was obvious. I should have known better. "I'm not going to run," he said. "I'm going to eat my lunch." Briefly, I felt bold again. I saw myself adding this lunch to my column of victories once I returned to the office. If we made it through this, then perhaps there was nothing in the world that we couldn't conquer. From post offices to movie theaters and the all-too-perilous family dinner at home. I was imagining what my mother would say if Isaac were to show up one Sunday evening when his lunch arrived. The same waitress brought it, although this time she didn't look at either of us. Her embarrassment was evident. Isaac's omelet was on a stack of thin paper plates, barely large enough to hold the food. The plastic fork and knife had been wrapped in a napkin and placed on top, a strangely delicate touch that she must have been responsible for. He unwrapped the knife and fork and placed the palm-sized napkin on his lap. "Do you mind if I start?" he said. "I hate my eggs when they're cold." He spoke so calmly I assumed he was joking, and I suppose to some degree he was. I tried to laugh. "Ha ha." But then he cut his omelet into 7 even pieces before taking the first bite. He chewed slowly. With every bite I was reminded that we were no longer, if ever, on the same side. He had finished his omelet by the time my order arrived on the standard cream-colored plates used for everyone other than Isaac. The waitress tried to walk away quickly, but I grabbed her wrist and told her I wanted to cancel my order. Tell Bill I said that I don't want to eat here. The poor child. She was struggling not to cry. We didn't make it any easier on her. Leave the plate, Isaac said to her. We're going to stay and eat it. She hurried back to the kitchen. I stared at the plate of chicken and mashed potatoes and blinked twice, childishly hoping I could make it vanish. Please, I said to him, let's leave now. He shook his head no. Not until we both finish our lunch, he said. That's what you wanted, isn't it? If that was his way of settling the score, then I thought I could play along just as well. For the next 10 minutes, I slowly took my food apart. With my first half-hearted stab into the chicken, all the momentum was gone. There was nothing we could change. I felt a regression back to my mother's kitchen table, where I'd spent many nights and afternoons laboring to finish a meal that my father had never shown up for and that my mother had refused. I'd always known that there was something cruel in her insistence that I eat every bite on my plate while my father's food grew cold next to me. She needed a victim beside herself. And when I finally looked up at Isaac after a few minutes and saw him smiling at me, I knew there was something slightly cruel lurking in his gaze. I was too busy creating a new story, though, to linger on that thought. In this story, Isaac and I were still heroes, and the fact that we chose to sit there and linger when every part of me wanted to run was proof of the sacrifices we were willing to make. When we left the restaurant and were back in the car, he said to me, now you know, this is how they break you, slowly, in pieces.
Wonderful. So as I was reading that scene, I was very touched by it, but it also reminded me of this scene in James Baldwin's Notes of a Native Son, when he, I think it's the essay where he talks about his father's funeral, but in the portion that takes place in a diner is when James Baldwin has gone to work in a defense plant in New Jersey, and on his and he keeps getting denied service over and over and over, and then on his last night he goes to a diner and again he is denied service, and so he takes his cup of water and throws it at the waitress, and of course there's almost a riot right there, and he gets chased down the street, I when I read that scene, that was kind of what I, you know, I felt like there was a sort of a literary antecedent, if you will. And I guess that brings me to my question, which is, you know, what were you reading as you were writing this book? Like, if you were to point to sort of literary antecedents, so to speak, what would you say are the books that influenced you?
this is my chance to commend Layla. It's also one of the most essential books for me when thinking, when writing and working through this novel, was a book by Sudanese writer Tayeb Salah called The Season of Migration to the North, which Layla wrote an absolutely remarkable and beautiful, lovely introduction for, and that is so great and such a wonderful way of actually working through this very slim and incredibly dense and complex novel. But in this novel, there's this sort of character who occupies a weird space where he's sort of both African and spends a lot of time in London. And one of the things that sort of has always compelled me about that was this understanding of the sort of cruelty that happens, that he performs sometimes in his relationship to these women. And that's a part of the sort of fetishization and romanticization and exoticization that happens when people begin to look at each other across through that gaze of the other. And in this particular scene where Isaac is sitting at this diner with Helen and he's the one who's bearing the brunt of that discrimination, there's an act of it's both sort of cruel and it's sort of necessary to what he says, that you have to sit here with me and bear this. Like, you cannot, you know, Helen's idea that Isaac is the one who's sort of being denied service. He's the one whose food is arriving on plastic plates. And Helen's response is, well, we need to walk away from this and we need to sort of step outside of this and run. And Isaac's insistence that, no, that's not what we do. Mm-hmm. What you do is exactly what I'm going to have to do right now, which is sort of sit here and not necessarily just endure this, but also you have to participate in this with me in order for you to have any understanding of what this impact is. Mm-hmm. Not that you sort of are fully able to inhabit that space with me, but to walk away allows you off the hook to some degree. Mm-hmm. And he refuses to let her do that. So her line that there is something slightly cruel lurking behind his gaze, there is something slightly cruel about that, but it's not a sort of, it's a cruelty based on a certain necessity, right? Like if you want to occupy, if you really want to feel any form of compassion, then you have to be able to experience this and know that this is what it's like.
That's interesting. Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. I mean, I guess when I was reading it, I do sort of see the thing that's happening with Season. Although in Season, I mean, there's this journey, and then there's the reverse, and so
Season has an incredibly like
yeah. I mean, I can see too with the structure because that's a beautifully structured book, and so I could see how that might have influenced this one. I was going to say something about that, but that thought has escaped. So I'm going to go with another one, which is that when I was reading this, I was also thinking about A Bend in the River. I don't know if that's a book that played any role at all when you were reading this one.
That book has always been very important to me. Very much so with my first novel, which is sort of a deliberate, carries deliberate strong echoes of that, where the character in the novel actually calls himself Salim, like the narrator in A Bend in the River. And there's a sort of deliberate conversation happening between that novel and A Bend in the River. This novel, really not at all. My concern wasn't at all trying to... If anything, it was... I wouldn't even say it was... It never came
That's
to mind.
So interesting, because when I guess the reason that I thought of it was because of the decade. And, you know, this is essentially the same decade that he was writing about, that you're writing about. So that was one of the books that I thought about. The other book that I thought was... relevant, but maybe this is just a bit far-fetched, but I don't know if you've read The Last Friend by Tahar Benjelloun, because it has this thing too where these two young men are have not quite a love story, but it's kind of the same thing that you're doing here with both of them getting swept up in that post-colonial optimism, and then they catch up with one another a couple of decades later, and of course they've both gone very, very different paths. I have a couple of other questions. In the section that you read to us when we first sat down, the narrator says that he had these ambitions, these adolescent ambitions of being a writer. And so I wondered about your own ambitions of being a writer. Like when did that start? Tell us a little bit about your journey to being a writer.
For me, I began, I'd say, I was about 15, 16, very much in response to growing up in the Midwest and growing up and going to a very sort of privileged private school, high school, where it was predominantly all white. In my family, we were one of the very sort of few working class, one of the very few minority families inside of this place. And realizing that suddenly now my identity was thrown into a much more complicated space. Like prior to that, we grew up in this sort of, sort of little suburb of Chicago where everyone seemed to come from everyone else. You know, I had friends who were Vietnamese, who were Latino, who were sort of European migrants, who just came from everywhere, and we were great together, and we all ran wild in the streets together. No one seemed to know anything about how kind of miraculous it was that we were all gathered together without any sense of problems that were supposed to come to that. And suddenly you grow older and you realize there are a lot of problems that you have to then begin to parcel out for yourself. And so it was at that age, that's exactly when you realize that you are more than just sort of denial, that you are also sort of a black in America. And that comes with its attending problems. And in that school, those problems were very much sort of thrown right in my face. You know, you are one of the only minorities. People were happy to sort of call you nigger, insult you directly to your face. And that too, at the same time, that it's not enough to only be angry, which was my sort of initial recourse, mm-hmm. was to sort of actually find a lot of rage for many years. Because I felt like, why be a part of this if I'm going to be rejected? Why partake in this culture, in this society? And I would then go home and pretend like I was going to just be completely Ethiopian, because why bother trying to be American if the American version was going to mean that I had to take insults and I had to, sort of find myself sort of stopped by the police every time I try to walk to school. So you just thought, well, forget this. Like I will abscond to another identity, a slightly romantic identity of being purely Ethiopian. which is how my parents thought of it, because there was no, if you're in Ethiopia, you don't have discrimination. You know, my parents had no idea really what it meant for me to experience this as a young man, because they had never grown up with that themselves. They had no sense of the sort of dramatic impact that has on your consciousness. Mm. So then writing became the only, or reading actually, before, long before writing, right. Writing became that sort of space out of that. You know, I began to find that I didn't have to, I could release some of that anger by not worrying about fitting into any place or anyone, or having to have anyone. And so books became this sort of great solitary space where I didn't worry about being alone anymore. But I found my way out of a lot of that frustration by reading. And I was, you know, sort of reading books that were written from people all over the world. But that began to sort of give me a certain consolation. And and then through that, I began to also sort of fall in love with language. Mm-hmm. And you begin to realize, well, if this is the thing that brings you so much joy and so much peace and so much happiness, purely sometimes just on the sort of power of a beauty of a sentence. You know, you someone writes a great line of poetry and you think that'd be kind of remarkable to be able to do the same thing and offer some of that same grace to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so writing became an extension of that. It became an extension of the sort of love of the kind of great pleasure that and saving grace that books brought to me.
Wonderful. That's wonderful. Tell me a bit about the kinds of writers that you were reading, because you mentioned that, you know, some of the, because you started out as a reader, as we all do. So what kind of writers were you reading?
At that point, it was really, you know, Baldwin and Ellison were some of the first ones. And then I loved a lot of sort of the early beat writers, because they seemed to sort of perform that rejection of society that I thought I was trying to do. So they validated my desire to spend all day in a coffee shop smoking cigarettes. And it made me feel really cool to do so. And that was really great. And then also...
And that was long before you moved to Paris, dude. It was
and long before people told you that was a cliche. So you're like, this is fine. I'm the only one who's doing this. No one else has ever thought of doing this before me. And really great. And it did sort of feel that way. There's something sort of greatly liberating about that, feeling like these characters and these books have done that, and not that many other people around you are doing that. So it makes that sort of non-normative behavior feel privileged. It makes it feel like... Mm-hmm. Like you're cool to some degree, right? There was this sort of great pleasure in feeling like, fine, I have no friends. I'm not going to go on a date anytime soon. It's okay. I'm fine. I have two friends right there in the audience. We've progressed since then. But that was great, though. I think it's sort of such an invaluable lesson to learn, not only just if you want to be a writer, but also just to sort of be a human being.
Yes.
It grants you a lot of space to be comfortable with yourself at a period when maybe you're not really willing to do so. And again, only because I had been so uncomfortable with myself for so long. And, you know, sort of not only was angry at the rest of the world, but probably sort of had a lot of self-loathing, I would imagine, to some degree, if I look back honestly. And so all of these things sort of help draw you out of that and realize, like, okay, it's okay to be who I am, and it's okay to be the sort of strange person who doesn't have to worry if whether or not they're going to be sort of black enough, or whether or not they're ever going to sort of fit into this privileged high school environment, that I can put all those attending anxieties to the side, and for at least a time just sort of engage with myself as a human being and see how much fun I can have with that.
Yeah. So when you are writing, so for example, you were mentioning Season for this, I know for me, for example, one of the great pleasures of writing a new or starting a new book is figuring out all the great books I'm going to get to read while I'm writing it. So what kinds of books are you reading while you're writing? Like, for example, for this book, do you reread?
I reread a lot. Also, this book was being written as I was having two small children born within a year of each other. So there wasn't a lot of actually outside reading happening. There's a lot of not sleeping. And a lot of struggling to find time to write in between that. So writing happened only in these weird spaces of like everyone is kind of nap time was never long enough. It's like
for them, their nap time.
My nap time was always. What happens when sort of everyone in the house is sort of quiet and you're left to yourself? And also, most of this book was sort of also written while living in France, and so there was you know, what I probably went back to the most was sort of poetry, actually, because I didn't actually have that much time to go sit through novels. I spent more time reading poetry during those phases, because if you're not going to be able to make it through a whole novel and you know you have, you know, maybe 5 hours of like conscious adult thought left in your brain, a poem works really well in that space, right? You're like, great, there's, you know, 2 minutes of my life and now I feel good about myself. But it also kind of restores your sort of sense of language in a way that's really lovely.
Yeah, poetry.
It brings you back to just sort of like tactile beauty of words. Mm-hmm. And that oftentimes, whenever you have like writer's block, that becomes one of the sort of great things.
Yeah.
Like you can sort of recuse yourself from narrative and the sort of obligations of creating characters and stories to find your way back into like sort of beautiful little image and beautiful sort of lines. And suddenly you're like, oh, right, there's the sort of amazing power of language to do things that are that allow you to express what's almost ineffable as closely as you possibly can with words.
Well, it's a beautifully written book. Thank you for writing it. And I think I just want to thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I think now people will be allowed to ask questions and there will be people passing microphones.
I love this book.
Thank you.
While I was reading it, there's a writer that I love, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who was embarking on a series of kind of very dark pieces about kind of the legacy of white supremacy and racism in America. So when I hit the diner scene, I was thinking, I wonder if Isaac has the kind of grace and the courage to go into this interracial relationship at this period in history, because he's not American.
Yeah.
He's coming from a place where the way he is not, doesn't have the same, you know, sort of freight that it does here. And I wondered, since that's not your experience really, if you came here too, what you think about his observing our complicated kind of relationship to race.
Yeah, I'd say, I love Ta-Nehisi, his work, and especially the essays that he does in The Atlantic. He does this sort of brilliant thing of not shying away from the way sort of profound psychological effects discrimination has on the people who are forced to bear it. He brooks no sort of attempt to sort of shy you away or release you from that. You know, he wants you to know that you look at us with that regard, and that doesn't fade easily. It's not just about sort of like, I'm going to discriminate against you overtly. Right, that's, we can sort of leave a lot of those things to the side, but it's all the sort of small, quiet forms of inattentiveness, of sort of presuppositions that that continue to sort of wound deeply. And Isaac's has, because you're right, Isaac is not coming, he's coming in from somebody who has, I think, already born so much more than like Helen's naivete towards what is about to happen. There's, I think, a slightly ironic gaze that Isaac has towards all that, because he's already come from so much more. And if you read, you know, when you read the novel, you realize that Isaac has already sort of experienced something similar, and not based on race, but also sort of based on class inside of Uganda. And he knows there's that diner scene, or that diner scene is echoed in a cafe scene that happens in Africa earlier on. So when he arrives at this diner scene, his invitation or sort of demand that Helen not walk away is also in some ways a sort of response to what his relationship to that moment in Africa is. So he bears that to some degree, perhaps with a greater capacity, because the stakes for him have always been so high. So for him, it's like that discrimination has a different impact on him by far, definitely, than it would for somebody else, because he knows he's come from a place where so much worse has happened. And at the same time, he looks at this sort of very peculiar sort of American thing of racial discrimination with a kind of contempt.
Sir, were you aware of the fact that in America, racism hasn't changed significantly since Birth of a Nation, the birth of the Ku Klux Klan in 1915, the movie that was produced? If so it was, we wouldn't have a Trayvon Martin that was murdered, and there should have been public outcry from the whole world.
No.
Nothing happened. That man was murdered. It's a racist act. Pardon me? I'm making a statement to ask a question, right? And you go back to Texas, a little town in Jasper, where they take a man walking down the road, and they put a chain around his neck and drag him down to a curvature and sever his head. Okay? So What does it begin? What does it end? I mean, America is has always been. It's not going to change significantly.
I'm reluctant to say that it won't change significantly. I do believe that things change, but I do also believe that it's important to acknowledge that within that change, there are still enormous failures that happen. Mm-hmm. That change is not. It's not a sort of total experience that happens in one particular movement, but we're not the same country that we were, even though we still may perform some of those frustrated, lingering techniques. And you're right, what happens, of course, somebody like Trayvon Martin, that is a sort of profound shame on what has happened and what the sort of country is still capable of doing. But that's still different from the sort of from having to pass anti-lynching laws in the 1950s, right? We have moved on to some degree. It doesn't mean that we have a perfect society, but it is part of the sort of ongoing progress and narrative that is this country's evolution.
I don't know if that's significant, because black
Americans
still cool.
Yeah.
If you spend a black person off enough, you'll find something that's criminal about them. Yeah. You know that right now in America.
We do have to take another question. Thank you.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Before I ask my question, I just want to compliment you. I think you're a beautiful person, and it's refreshing to hear you speak.
Well, thank you. I think you're pretty amazing right now as well.
Thank you.
How old are you?
26. So I haven't read your book, but in the lobby, I noticed that the title and the names, the words are crossed out, and the texture is like a chalkboard.
Yeah.
What was the inspiration for your design?
I wish I could take credit for that. I basically came up with the title, and then some really remarkable people at Random House did the rest. But I love the design, and I love the cover. And there are parts of the novel that sort of echo exactly that scene. There's a moment where two of the characters are in this sort of classroom in Kampala, and they are making things up. They're pretending to be able to do something that they can't, and they're writing all these things on the wall. So that chalkboard texture of the cover always reminds me of that particular scene in the novel. But two, there's also characters in the novel are shedding their names constantly, and they're taking on new names, and they're adopting new names, and they're renaming things as well. So like the renaming of Kampala to the capital is a deliberate decision on the part of this character, right, to take this sort of city, this landscape, and he says Kampala belongs to Uganda, but what I want is to actually take this place and make it mine. That this is not, what I'm there for isn't for the sort of traditional reasons. I'm there for my own very private, selfish reasons, which are to sort of go there to want to be a writer. So he decides to strip Kampala of that and name it the capital, the same way that he also strips himself of his own identity. He strips himself of the names that his family has given him in order to become something else. And his name is a series of evolutions. It's this process of adopting and taking on multiple different roles and identities until finally he's given one that he has to assume, and that he willingly assumes because it comes at a great cost and sacrifice. So that crossing out of all our names is part of that process. It's part of the fact that, like, you're given a name in this story, but sometimes that name is not a permanent fixture to you. It is only one name that you were temporarily bear, and the characters are sort of perform that, especially one character in particular performs that throughout the novel.
Hi, I haven't read the new book yet, but I read and loved your previous two books. And I wanted to ask you more about writing women, because I found your, you know, women characters in the... am I screaming? Okay, yeah, sorry. So beautifully done and very nuanced, and you give them very self-respecting sort of emotional and political lives, not without blockages. I mean, you do address the blockages across cultural relationships, and I was interested to hear your reference to the... Tayyip Saleh book, Seas of Migration to the North, because that book is hard on women, but mm-hmm. correctly so. I did Middle East studies, and that's the text you read to sort of disabuse yourself of your Orientalism before you go to the Middle East. It's like, get it out of your head. It's all sexy and whatnot, but there's a lot of pain. But it's hard, you know, but I think it's also good. And I'm interested to see with Helen, it seems that you're going there a little bit more deeply than perhaps you did in the previous two books.
Yeah. Helen, you know, there are always things that you try not to sort of think of as being too overt when you're writing that you hope sort of just arrive rather organically. But Helen, I knew, was sort of a character when she introduces herself and she starts talking about how she likes to scream, or she goes out in the backyard when she reads because she wants to be able to scream just so she can hear her own voice. And that once those lines were written, I realized they sort of became kind of a watermark for her character, that they sort of set the threshold for what she was going to be in the novel, which was deliberately strong and deliberately a woman who is choosing not to perform the normal roles that her society and her culture would have her do, not just in relationship with her Isaac, but even long before then, right? She is a social worker, but she's also someone who's chosen not to sort of bother with trying to get married or have a family. She is a part of this community. At the same time, she knows that this is not, she doesn't ever sort of really feel that deeply rooted or attached to it. She wants something else. She's there, and yet at the same time, you can see her sort of pushing for something more even before Isaac arrives. And their relationship becomes, briefly for her, this sort of very problematic, romantic way of trying to find that initial release. And hopefully over the course of the novel, they move on to something much more complex and much more sort of profound. But her initial sort of, I think the sort of part of the power of her character, at least for me, was knowing that she was a woman who was, who had set herself apart from everything else that people were expected her to be. And that makes her sort of very compelling to me. And she has this relationship with also this man, David, who's her boss. It's not a sexual relationship, but just a sort of profound friendship, where there is also, between the two of them, there are two people who stand outside of the norms of this sort of society and this culture, and they're very closely linked even before Isaac gets into the story.
Can I ask a follow-up question about that? Because I just remembered what I was going to ask about season earlier. So in season, you have the characters of Mustafa Said and you have the narrator. And I guess this is, now I see what you were talking about with the influence. So I wondered if in this one, it were kind of intended to mirror what's going on between Isaac and the narrator as well, where one is sort of a more sophisticated man who kind of, he's been around, you know what I mean? Yeah. He's been around the block a few times, so he kind of guides the other one. And I think you do a similar structure in this book.
And it's true, in that case, the narrator is, he's telling the story of Mustafa Said. Yes. And there's a lot of uncertainty around that story, too, mm-hmm. that's sort of happening. And Isaac is, it's hard to talk about these characters because their names are all distorted.
Thank you for coming, Dino. I too haven't read your book, but I think I have read an excerpt from it in The New Yorker.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So I have a question. Any particular reason why you chose Kampala or Uganda for the setting of this?
No.
Could you have chosen any other African country, post-colonial country?
I guess you could. No, I couldn't have.
Maybe. Oh, I'm still, yeah.
The sort of compelled by two particular reasons. One, first and foremost, was the sort of character who is Ethiopian and who has the sort of family legacy of the sort of growing up in a village that in my imagination is very much rooted in the village that my father had grown up in. And he is his first attempt at leaving home, his sort of first attempt at migration, is to sort of go for, to him, the most romantic place possible. And so his desire to go to Kampala is based on a slightly naive romanticism, that he knows that there was the sort of conference of writers that happened in 1962, and he knows that his desire is to perhaps someday now want to be a writer because he wants to set himself apart from the community and culture that he's grown up in. And so that becomes the place that he wants to go to. He wants to go there, not because he knows really anything else about it, but because he has the sort of romantic fascination mm-hmm. with this place because of this thing that he knows a marginal bit about. But what he really knows about is that there were writers.
Yeah.
And there was this group of men who were gathered there. And the fact that they had all gathered there at this particular point in time points to some great possibility for him. It points to the fact that there is this potential to sort of tell stories, for him to write his own story. And in order for him, or he believes in order for him to do that, part of what he has to do is separate himself, to leave home and go somewhere else. And we know that story really well, even outside of Africa. We know that story, Go West, Young Man, is predicated entirely on that. Mm-hmm. Leave the things that you know and set off for somewhere else and make your own destiny, make your own claims. We know that story very much as all the migrants who came to America from the very beginning of this country. They leave their homes, they oftentimes shed their names, and they come to this country and they adopt new identities. They adopt new forms of being in order to try to make something different out of themselves from what they believe they could do at home. So that becomes the sort of origin for why he chooses it. I'd also spent not a substantial amount of time, but maybe about a month in Kampala while working as a journalist and covering some of the conflicts in the north of that country at that time. And it just sort of struck me, and I was sort of fascinated, and spent a lot of time while writing those, while doing that reporting, doing a lot of research on sort of how Uganda sort of became what it is at that particular moment, right? So how you moved from independence to Obote to Amin, back to Obote, to Museveni, and all the sort of complex political machinations and all the sort of dark massacres that happened in the country during that process, the sort of Luwero Triangle massacres, all the sort of lost lives that happened and the sort of great amount of bloodshed that had occurred during that period of time. I never felt like I was ever able to probably actually fully write about that and the very small stories that I was doing that were centered on the sort of conflict in the north of that country. So it had a lingering presence in my imagination and a lingering presence in my mind, and I felt sort of naturally compelled to want to return back to it. You know, once the character had set that place as his curiosity or as his sort of romantic fantasization, then I decided to follow that, and then I realized that, of course, that there are many things that I sort of found compelling and loved about that place and at that time. Mm.
Thank you so much. I have a question. In your opinion, the changing or the shedding of the names, do you see it as an evolving or a devolving in the character of the person or in the content of a people and their culture?
So that's a very hard question. In the context of my character, I see it as both. Very few things to me are sort of either one or the other. The sort of narrator's decision to leave home and set himself apart from his sort of family and the history that he would have inherited. There's a great loss that comes with that, and the character acknowledges that finally at one point in time when he realizes that that something massive had been sacrificed in order for him to have that freedom, that no one really knows him, no one knows where he comes from or what he cares about or what's comprised his person. So there's an enormous loss that comes with that, and I think it's hard to ignore that loss and only focus on the sort of gains that come with being with a sense of freedom that might come with having set yourself aside like that. And at the same time, I do think that there is, for him, I can't talk about, it's hard to talk about a sort of society in a larger sense than that, but for him, there is this also other possibility that's open to him, the chance to make something of himself different than what he would have been able to do had he remained tied to the same place, had he sort of followed the same paths and traditions of his family, that he knows that he's not that person, that he wanted something to do something else, and in order to do something else, it means leaving home sometimes. And there's for him, it doesn't always work out the way he wanted to, but you do have to sort of live your life to some degree the best way you possibly know how, and even if it doesn't work out that way, it's, all you have is just that one chance to do it, so.
All right, well, thank you all for coming.
Thank you all very much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.